Shabbat Shalom and welcome to United Israel World Union. This is our Sabbath morning Torah study. We're working through the Bible's book of Genesis according to the ancient triennial cycle readings. Before I get into class today, I would ask you to keep in your prayers two people that are on my heart this morning. One is my good friend Red Tyler. He had a trip to the emergency room earlier in the week, and so just continue to lift him up. And then my good friend Mark Lloyd is also in need of some prayer this morning. Many of you know Mark. He and I have been friends since before we were gray. I have pictures to prove it. So praying for Mark this morning. In fact, after the class today, Dave and I are going to go visit with him. And so I'm going to let you know early that we're not going to have a dialogue, and I apologize for that up front, but this is unavoidable. So we're going to make a trip to see him, and so keep us in your prayer for that travel. And then finally, one other thing while you're just throwing prayers this way, Dave on the way this morning had a breakdown on a trailer he was pulling behind his truck, and I went and got him, and one of our good friends here went with him, and they are looking at the ox in the ditch right now. So at any rate, keep those things in your prayers, please. Last week I was out, as you know, and we had a funeral for another family friend, and that all went very well. Also, as good as can be expected for a time such as that. Today, though, we're picking up with this idea of Jacob's return. And in a way, in my previous two teachings, I focused on the return of Jacob. But in a way, today's teaching, today's Torah portion from the triennial portion of readings is the culmination, if you will, of a journey of, let's call him, the Torah's prodigal patriarch. The Torah's prodigal patriarch. Now, by prodigal, sometimes people define that as someone who wastes their money or something of that nature, but it doesn't necessarily have to imply that. I mean by prodigal, one who is returned after an absence. So we have this story of Jacob, who's been away for quite a while, and he comes back. You'll remember that Abraham did a lot of journeys. Isaac never left the land. But Jacob does indeed leave the land, and he's gone for an extended period of time. So this last couple of classes, he's been making his way back. From Paddan Aram. And he is coming up on his arrival back in the land. And so I want to use today's class to focus on that entry back in, if you will. And so I want to give a little bit of an introduction and tell you some of the thoughts that are on my mind. Over the past few days, as I studied this particular portion, I was led in a way that I really didn't expect. And so I'll tell you up front, one of the things that really caught my attention is this idea that sometimes some of you, some of us, let's make it less personal, some of us make excuses for our biblical heroes, men and women. We sometimes will look at the behaviors of people within the biblical narrative, and even if we think, I would never do that, we excuse their behavior. And we do that for a lot of reasons. I mean, we may say, well, you know, it was part of God's plan or whatever, but it sometimes I think we look at these with, what's the expression, rose-colored glasses, and we tend to excuse it. And I personally am at a place in my biblical quest and my biblical studies that I really don't want to do that. I really want to look at these stories and be quite honest about my feelings and my emotions and what it is that the text speaks to me. Because I think otherwise what we end up doing is not really grappling with the text. I want you to literally roll up your sleeves and get into the story and be honest. Look at these stories and say, oh, I don't know. I don't see how you could do that. Or because the biblical narrative is written in such a way, I believe, that it wants to invite us in. And a lot of times we prevent ourselves from going into the story by our own preconceived notions. Okay, so we'll talk about that a little bit. So Jacob has been away from the land of promise for about 2 decades, and now he's coming back. In his departure, he dreamt of messengers. Some translations say angels. I won't argue the point. In some ways, I don't have to make these non-angelic beings. I mean, they appear in a dream. They're ascending and descending on a ladder, which reaches the heavens. So it's a little bit more than, say, a messenger that, you know, isn't angelic. I mean, it could very well be. In fact, at the top of this sulam, as it says in Hebrew, this ladder, it says Jehovah is at the top. So this is more than just your average messenger types. But when he departs the land, he encounters these messengers, these malakim. And upon his return, he also encounters malakim. In fact, in the story of his return in last week's narrative, once again we meet with this word. Now, the debate is, are they the same messengers? Are they different messengers? And we had some good discussion about that last week. People entertained that and talked about it. Jacob's exile is what I've referred to his time outside the land as. His exile was long. You know, 20 years is a long time for a human, even in biblical patriarchal years. For us, it's even longer. They lived longer, but 20 years he's gone, so it's a long time. But here's the other thing. For Jacob, it was a time of learning and even transformation. His character is built through this time. We talked about some of the stories about Jacob's questionable methodology. And again, we probably made excuses for things. Well, you know, his mom heard from God, and so it's okay to lie to your blind dad who's in bed if your mom heard from God. And, you know, I'm sorry. It's not that I'm being sarcastic for any reason other than I feel impressed, let's just say, to make us think and look at these stories. But he's learned a lot. He left. When he left, you know, he's this trickster. And he meets with the master of all tricksters. Turns out his uncle is the master. And so because of that, he sort of gets a dose of his own medicine, as we like to say. Now, last week I touched, or the week before, my last class, I touched on Hosea. And I want to begin there. I want to begin in that 12th chapter of Hosea. I'll give you a little bit of verbal commentary first. But I want to touch on that again for a very important reason, because one of the things that we see is that in Hosea chapter 12, we have this interesting prophecy. And in this interesting prophecy of Hosea, it includes certain aspects about the life of Jacob. And he weaves this narrative of Jacob's actual life, the historical Jacob, with a prophetic, almost a denouncing of the modern Israel at his time based on Jacob's life. He says that God has a controversy with Jacob. And then he begins to recount historical elements of Jacob. You know, he struggled in the womb. He wrestled with this angel. We're going to read it again just to kind of set the tone for today's class. But he alludes several times to the patriarch's life. So let's do this. Let's go to the book of Hosea, and I want to read to you just a few verses from chapter 12, because this sets the tone for what I want to do. So I want to go to Hosea chapter 12, beginning in verse 4. We're going to read three verses. It says, now, by the way, just to give you the context, if you begin in verse 1 through verse 3, that kind of paves the way for what follows in this prophecy, where he talks about there's this controversy that God has with Jacob. And he talks about his unfaithfulness and so forth. Let's start in verse 3. Jehovah has a controversy with Judah and will punish Jacob according to his ways. According to his doings will he recompense him. Now, what does that sound like to you? Does it sound like Hosea is saying, Judah and Jacob are the loveliest people you'll ever meet? That they deserve nothing but praise? Or does it seem to suggest that trouble is coming for the actions and behaviors? Sounds more like the latter to me. Now, here we go. So then he immediately goes into this. It says, he took his brother by the heel in the womb, and by his strength he fought with God. He strove with an angel and prevailed. He wept. He made supplication to him. He would find him at Bethel, as we say in South Louisiana, and there he would speak with us. Now, I pointed this out last class, but it's been 2 weeks. You've probably forgotten it, so I have to do it again. Get this. What Hosea is saying at his time is that something that happened at Bethel, the story should speak with us. In other words, it could have said, and there he spoke with him. That's what really happened. Unless what's said in that story is actually speaking to those beyond his day. Get that, okay? Now, if you go down to verse 13, it says, and Jacob fled into the country of Aram, and Israel served for a wife, and for a wife he kept sheep. Now, what does that have to do with a modern day, actually it's ancient now, but in Hosea's time, he is referring back to events in Jacob's life that he's saying are applicable in his own. Well, here's what I'm doing to you today. I'm saying they are today as well. That the words which were spoken to Jacob all these many, many years ago were relevant in the time of Hosea. They're relevant now if we have eyes to see and ears to hear what the prophet is speaking. So there's something going on at Bethel. Here in the story in Genesis, more than history is being recorded is my premise. Now, it was at Bethel that Yaakov happened upon a place. It says that he's fleeing. He happens upon a place, and he decides to spend the night there because it's late. And he takes one of the stones of that place, and he puts it for a headrest, and he goes to sleep. And in his sleep, he has this dream, which I mentioned a moment ago, and he learned in this dream, it's a dream, that his descendants, there were certain things about his descendants that he learned. Number one, his descendants would be numerous. They would be, as it's said in the dream, as the dust of the earth. Now, how many kids does Jacob have at this point? None. He learns that his descendants will be spread abroad from the west to the east, to the north, and to the south. At the time, he didn't even have kids, but he gets this prophetic vision that occurs to him in his sleep. And here's something I want you to really, really get, because I think people miss this part. Even though they read it, they don't let it absorb into their brain. And that is that his descendants are to be a blessing to all the families of the earth. If you remove this part, if you don't focus on this part, and Israel, the descendants of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and Israel is just focused on the fact that they are going to be blessed. If you skip the part about being a blessing to others at all costs, it's your one mission. Yeah, you're going to be blessed. Anybody that talks about you, curses you, they'll be cursed. Those that bless you will be blessed. Then it says this, and be a blessing. And in you and in your seed, all the families of the earth will be blessed. So what's the purpose of being blessed if we don't bless other people? It's kind of selfish. If we just think, oh, I am so blessed. Look at my life. Look at my, everything is perfect in my life. My children are beautiful. Look at Seth. You know, if we go through those things and then we don't look at the people around us. And in other words, get this point, because the story today, I think, really draws this out and presents us with a moral dilemma. Did Jacob's children behave properly? And furthermore, are Jacob's descendants today behaving properly? Uh-oh. Or do we make excuses? Do we sugarcoat? Do we whitewash? If Israel does it, they're correct and they're right and they're holy and they're blameless. That's ridiculous. It's not biblical. It's not true. And the sooner we get that, the more biblical and true we are. Right? Does that make sense? Okay. So when he's told this thing about being a blessing to all the families of the earth, I want you to remember that the blessing, when he hears this piece of the blessing was told to his father before him and to his father before him. Well, guess what? It goes to you as well. If you're going to be blessed, and I pray that you are, be a blessing, and through you, let your life be a blessing to other people. Otherwise, what good is it? Furthermore, he's promised in that original dream back in Genesis 28, not only that he's preparing, God's preparing him in this dream because he's going to be going away, and he tells him, but I will be with you, and I'll bring you back. Now, that's comforting. A lot of times in the ancient world, people thought that the God, whatever God, was over a certain region, like the God of Mesopotamia, the God of Syria, the God, this God, the gods of Egypt, that they kind of controlled their little property, but they didn't cross the border. Israel's God does something different. If you don't behave here, he tells them in Leviticus that the land is mine. You're here sort of as a tenant. Guess what happens if you don't behave? You're out. And guess how you get back in? You start behaving again. But here's the beautiful story within the story. What God says is, I'm going to exile you, but I'll be with you. Ezekiel the prophet makes this comment at one place. I think it's Ezekiel chapter 11, where he says that I will be for them a little sanctuary in all the countries into which they go. So the beautiful thing about Israel's God, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, is that he says, if you don't behave, you have to go, but I'll go with you. I'll take care of you. I'll bring you back. Now, there is that whole hiding of the face thing, but it's a different lesson. What I want you to think about now is the fact that God has promised to be with and to bring back. And Jacob wakes up and realizes that God is in this place. And he's so moved that he sets up this rock that he's used as a headrest, and he sets it up and he pours oil on it, making it, get this for all you trivia buffs, the first Messiah in the Bible. Because Messiah means to anoint. To anoint means to rub or pour or smear oil on an object, a person, or something of that nature. So he, in a way, it's a pointing towards this messianic identity, this idea of an anointed, something special. He calls this place, because of that, something very, very much. He just had this dream and God speaks to him. So what does he call it? The house of God. He's encountered God here. He said, this is the gate of heaven. And so he names this place Bethel, and he makes a vow. Now listen to his vow. This is where I really want to go this morning. Go with me to Genesis 28, because I want to read. We're going to see if Jacob sticks with his vow or not. You know, it's important, by the way, when people make a vow. I believe that words are very important. If I tell you, John, if I say I'm going to do this and I don't do it, that's a problem. I think it's a big, big problem. I think our culture and our society, we sort of don't think about it like it's that big of a deal. Yeah, it's no big deal. You know, get over it. I said I would do that. I'm not going to do that anymore. You had an example of that this week. So it's one of those things where if you tell somebody you're going to do, so a vow. The book of Bamidbar, the book of Numbers, covers vow. I mean, look, you got to do this. If it comes out of your mouth, be careful. Be careful what you say. If you commit to something, do it. Now, Genesis 28, I want you to look with me at verse 20. And Jacob vowed a vow. I love the way the Hebrew is very repetitive to stress something. He vowed a vow. Like we would say, I made a vow. In Hebrew, it repeats it. How do you do a vow? How do you do a vow? You vow a vow. It says he vowed a vow saying, if God, Elohim he uses, if Elohim will be with me and will keep me or guard me in the way that I go, and will give me bread to eat, he kind of stacks up the requirements, he's making a deal with God, and clothing to wear, so that I come back to my father's house in peace, then Jehovah will be my God. And this stone, which I've set for a pillar, shall be God's house. And of all that you shall give me, I will surely give the tenth to you. And then Jacob lifts up his feet and he moves forward. So think about the power in these words. He says, look, if God will take care of me and give me clothing and food and bring me back and guard me on the way, bring me back in peace. He says specifically, bring me back in peace, then you'll be my God. And I'll serve you. And I'll call this place the house of God. In other words, you do your side? Look, Jacob knew how to manipulate. He's even trying to manipulate God. If you do these things, I'll be your servant. And like God would say, well, thank you very much. Thank you. I appreciate that. But he does have this bold courage. This is what I love about Jacob. He's got this courageous, hey. All right, so here's what I thought about. He specifically gives God a list. Now, what I want to show you today, God fulfilled his side. In fact, that language we're going to read in a few minutes, it says specifically that God brought him back in peace. Has Jacob lacked any clothing? Does he have a bunch of sheep now, a bunch of women, a bunch of kids? Oh, he's been taken care of. He's got more women than anybody needs, right? I mean, it's a fact. You read the story, he's got four women, he's got all these children. Now, it's interesting that today's reading ends at Bethel, the very place where he uttered these words. So you depart, you return. A friend of mine who studies the Hebrew Bible, he taught me Hebrew, Yochanan, you know him, Johnny Powell. He says that if you summarize the Bible, like it's a big book, especially mine, it's real fat. If you summarize the Bible, it's the story of depart and return. And I thought about that. I thought, I don't know if I would summarize it that way, but think about it. You're in the garden. There's a departure. The goal then is to get back. Children of Israel are in the land. They depart. Goal is to get back. It's the story of return. How many times in the Bible does the charge go forth? Return unto me, and I'll return unto you. Zechariah 1:3. Malachi 1:3, Zechariah 3:7. This idea, it's up to you, though. If you return, he'll return. So I like the idea. So he comes back to the same place from which he left. When he departed, he was a solitary man. He had basically nothing. He leaves he leaves in flight. He's being pursued by his brother, who wants to kill him, by the way, because he's just, I don't know, he took his birthright and his blessing and, you know, a few other little details. But that's okay, because it was part of the plan. Right? I know what you're thinking. When he returns, though, it says specifically he comes back and he says in his prayer when he comes back, we covered all this. I just have to give you the introduction. He says this, he says, I left a one man and I've come back as two camps. And I told you, I think that's a prophetic picture because Jacob left and the return is going to be signified by this indication. Now, as Hosea said in the passage we just read, Jacob has been a fighter from the womb. He's been fighting since the very womb. And he doesn't stop his whole life, basically. He has striven with man and with God and prevailed. Now he finds himself back at Bethel. And when it says that he wanted to come back in peace, or when he requests that he be brought back in peace, that was a condition for him accepting Jehovah as his God, right? Remember when he was coming back, what was he fearful of? He was afraid that his brother was going to kill him. So the odds are stacked against a peaceful return. I mean, the one thing he knows is that when he left, his brother was breathing threats to kill him. When he comes back, he sends the messengers and says, go check. And they go and they run and check. And they said, hey, Jacob, your brother's coming. And he's got 400 men with him. So this whole thing about coming back in safety, Jacob has to rely that God's truly going to do what he said he was going to do. And does he? Yeah. Esau runs up to him and kisses him on the neck. He's happy to see him. Jacob tries to give him, you know, a blessing and look, I've given you all this. And he said, I got plenty, keep it. And Jacob forced him to take it. But I want you to see, he came back. Everything that was in that vow concerning Jacob was fulfilled on God's part. So it is with Israel, Jacob's descendants. God is fulfilling and has fulfilled his promises to Israel. Now it's Israel's turn to examine itself, himself, herself, and see, are we living our life according to the part that we said? So look at Genesis 38. In Genesis 38, 18, let's see, I'm sorry, 33, 18. I'm about to say, we didn't got that far. What am I doing? 33, 18. By the way, this is the very first verse of the Torah reading today, and it begins at a white space in the ancient Hebrew. So this is a natural place to begin the story. And it says, and Jacob came to Shalem, or Shalem. You know what this word means? It means peace, right? And a city of Shechem, I'm reading this translation that I'm going to talk about, which is in the land of Canaan, when he came from Paddan Aram and pitched his tent before the city. This translation and many translations take Shalem as a place. Like Shalem is a city, but this is talking about a city called Shechem already. So is this like a suburb of Shechem? Now, there is a place called Shalem. Remember, Melchizedek is the king of Shalem. So you have to ask yourself, is that what it means? In Hebrew, it can mean, and I think it does here, Tabor translates it this way, that he came peaceably to a city. So he arrives in peace. Well, that makes sense to me. He told God, if you bring me back in peace, and it says, here's the story of the arrival back, and the writer of Scripture wants us to know. You did. He came back in peace. So I like that. I think it's more accurate to say that he returned peaceably. Now, I wanted to touch on one other thing before I get into the reading and then comment further, but Bethel occurs seven times in Scripture attached to another word. The writers of Scripture often say, but it was called something else at first. Luz, L-U-Z, Luz. This place called Bethel. Now remember, Jacob goes to this place. It's a place before he names it Bethel. He names it Bethel because he has this encounter with God and he anoints the pillar and he calls it the house of God. But that was a place called Luz at first. Now what does Luz mean? This is something important. We're going to talk about that, but let me show you first of all. Go back to Genesis 28:19, just to kind of lay the groundwork for this insight. Verse 19, Genesis 28, and he, meaning Jacob, called the name of that place Bethel, but the name of that city was called Luz at first. Now, if it just happened there, that'd be one thing. But what if I told you that of the seven times that Luz is mentioned, five of those add a phrase, but it was called this at first. And of those five, they're the only ones specifically talking about this place. So for some reason, every time this place is mentioned, it throws that in there. Now, let's look at another one, Genesis 35:6, because this is in our reading today. Actually, it's in next week's, 35:6. No, it's in this week. 35:6. Okay, so Yaakov came to Luz, which is in the land of Canaan, that is Bethel. See, it's like they always want you to know, Luz is Bethel, Bethel is Luz. Don't forget that. Why do they keep doing that? That is Bethel. He and all the people that were with him, and he built there an altar and called the place El Bethel. So he's renaming this place again. God, house of God. All right? Why is he adding another reference to El in there? All right, just some things to make us think. And then one other, go with me to Genesis 48. Genesis 48, verse 3. Now, just to kind of give you the context, this is where Jacob, an elderly Jacob, is blessing Joseph's sons. And look at verse 2, actually. And one told Jacob and said, "Behold, your son Joseph comes to you." And Israel strengthened himself and sat upon his bed. And Jacob said to Joseph, "El Shaddai appeared to me at Luz in the land of Canaan and blessed me and said to me, 'Behold, I will make you fruitful and multiply you, and I will make of you a multitude of people,'" and so forth and so on. This example, right, he's referring to the place only by the original name. So it's one of those exceptions. But you still know where he's talking about. Where did God appear to him? At Luz, at Bethel. This is just a thought that I have. In Hebrew, Luz means to turn aside, to depart. It's a turning point, a fork in the road. Now, I'm being metaphorical. I want to go allegorical on you for a minute. I always warn people when I do that. But it indicates a crook, a sharp turn, a departure. And so, in a way, figuratively, the word came to be associated with devious or crooked. And so think about it. I mean, even in our language, you could say that's crooked. It just means it's not straight. Well, we carry that in our language into defining, say, the actions of somebody. That guy's a crook. What does that mean? He's a loser. He's a loser. What does that mean? It just means he's crooked. He's not straight. So in Hebrew, they do those things too. I mean, it's because it's an image. It's a picture that God wants us to see. Now, there's something else. So I started thinking about this. Jacob comes to this place, which was called Crooked or, you know, something like that. And he calls it the house of God. And so then I thought, don't go there because it's kind of hard to see. What are you trying to say here? But then I started thinking, wait a minute. It can also mean almond, an almond tree, almond wood. Now, what does an almond look like? Is an almond branch crooked? Yeah. There are prophetic visions. Jeremiah has a vision. He said, "What do you see, Jeremiah?" And he said, "Behold, I see an almond branch." And God tells him, "You've seen well, and here's what I'm going to do." Remember that story? Now, guess what else? Guess where else the almond tree comes in? In the life of Jacob, you remember, he took some sticks from certain trees, and he peeled them off. He peels them off, and one of those is the branch of the Luz. Now, what I'm trying to suggest here, what I'm thinking about, that's in chapter 30, verse 37 of Genesis. If you look, it's one of the branches. There's poplar, there's almond. But I'm wondering if perhaps there's not a deeper meaning in the text. And I don't always do this. You know this. But in my mind, I'm inclined to think that there's some connection between the repetition of, "But it was at Luz, and it was at Luz that God met me," and, you know, on and on and on, and it becomes the house of God. Something happens at Bethel, which was formerly called Luz, and in Jacob's own life, something happened when he peeled away off of this branch. Could it be? And I admit, you know, whenever you do this, sometimes you invite speculation. I thought about one must peel away the devious and crooked in order to reveal God's plan. In order to transition from one place to another, there has to be a peeling away. Just think about that. Jacob seems to have learned lessons along the way. He's no longer known as a supplanter, as Yaakov. His name was changed to Israel, this one who fights with God. Now, interestingly enough, though, Jacob is still called Jacob at times. Avram, once his name has changed to Abraham, we don't call him Avram anymore. He's Avraham. God says, your name will no longer be Avram, it's Avraham, and he's never called Avram again. Sarai is never called Sarai again. Her name is changed by God to Sarah. She's just Sarah. You don't call her Sarai anymore. Jacob, your name is no longer Jacob, it's going to be Israel. And then throughout the text, it might be Jacob, it might be Israel, it might be Israel, it might be Jacob. But it indicates to me, somewhat of a struggle within Jacob. He at times is the supplanter, at times he's this other character. Jacob is a mixed bag. So are his descendants. It's a constant struggle. It's a fight. He's been fighting since the womb. Now, thus far in our story, everything that God promises to the patriarch Jacob, to our prodigal patriarch, comes to pass. He takes care of him. God's with him. He appears to him in dreams when he's in Paddan Aram. Tells him about the sticks and all these other things. He tells him there, go back to the place where we first met. And he brings him back, and he brings him back in peace. So God could say, he says, I'm not going to leave you until I do that which I promised. Now finish with Jacob. This is where we, in a way, we pick up. So one of the things that I wanted to bring up, though, and I mentioned this at the beginning, we're going to read in just a moment, and then I'm going to comment a little bit on his descendants. The question becomes, what remains for Jacob, for this covenant partnership, is for his family to fall in line. Now, when I say family, I mean literally the wives, the women, the children of Jacob, but I also mean the broader family of Jacob needs to fall in line. Because I think what we read about in the stories of Jacob's family in Scripture, in the historical books, also point to their behaviors and so forth of the descendants. For instance, there's idols in the camp. They still have idols in the camp. Still hadn't gotten rid of those. They have to go. Now, in the story of Jacob, he does, in fact, tell them, and we're going to read that in just a moment, take those idols, get rid of them. Why? Why is he getting rid of the idols? Now, think about this. Here's the other thing. Remember when Rachel hid the idols and it said Jacob didn't know about it? And he told Laban, you go find those. Anybody you find them with, they're going to die. And you know the story. Laban couldn't find the idols. And so we assume, I guess, that maybe Jacob doesn't know to this point that they have idols. Let me tell you something. At some point between then and today, whether he knew all along, I don't know. But at some point, he becomes aware, because today, all of a sudden, Jacob's like, y'all got to get rid of those idols because we're going to the house of God. And here's what I say. Y'all need to get rid of them idols. Me too. I mean, we need to examine our life. Do we have things that are idolatrous in our life? Because I'm sure that we probably do. We may not really know about them, or we kind of know about them, or we, you know, like I used to always joke, and some of you are in different places, so this is not me preaching at you about diet, but when I first decided years ago not to eat pork anymore, it took me a long time to look up pepperoni and verify for absolute sure that it was pork. Because I didn't want to look that deep. Or whatever. That's my point. You want to make sure any idols that we have, and I'm not associating your diet with idols, but as a principle, what can we do to live our life more biblically, right? So it's easier to say descendants behave than it is to actually do it. Like, have you ever had children who don't do exactly, you know, the best thing? you know? But now let's back it up. You were kids too. And how many of you walked on water? Or however you want to define. Idols in the camp. They have to come out before returning. And so Jacob has to do that. Now, if Jacob's descendants are to be a blessing around them, anciently, like in our story, or in our modern day, they have to act a certain way. Now, you be the judge. We're going to do this in just a moment. You be the judge. As I read the story, you tell me if Jacob's descendants are being a blessing to those around them. Don't make excuses for them. No, I'm not going to try to get you to think a certain way. I want you to, but listen to this. So we're going to begin. I'm reading from the Transparent English Bible. Very literal. So we're in Genesis 34. We're going to begin in verse 18. So my translation is going to be much more literal than yours if you don't have that translation, but that's okay. But listen closely. Now, I always say Psalm 119:18 in Hebrew, open my eyes, and I will look for wonderful things from your Torah. So let's do that. And Jacob came peacefully to the city of Shechem, that is in the land of Canaan, in his going from Paddan Aram, and he set camp before the face of the city. And he acquired the portion of the field where he had stretched out there his tent from the hands of the sons of Hamor, father of Shechem, for 100 kesita, a portion of money. And he positioned there a slaughter place, an altar, and called to it El Elohei Israel. And Dinah, the daughter of Leah, whom she brought forth to Jacob, went out to see the daughters of the land. And Shechem, son of Hamor the Hivite, a chieftain of the land, saw her and took her and lay down with her, and he brought her low. And his life breath joined with Dinah, daughter of Jacob, and he loved the woman, and he spoke to the heart of the young woman. And Shechem said toward Hamor his father, saying, take for me this girl for a woman. And Jacob heard that he had defiled Dinah his daughter, and his sons were with his acquired livestock in the field. And Jacob kept silent until their coming. And Hamor, father of Shechem, went out toward Jacob to speak with him. And the sons of Jacob came from the field at their hearing, and the men were caused sorrow. And it burned them exceedingly because he had done folly against Israel to lie down with a daughter of Jacob. And thus is not done. Now, this reading is a little bit long, but bear with me. A couple of chapters. And Hamor spoke with him, saying, Shechem, my son, his life breath is drawn to your daughter. Give her, please, to him for a woman, and cause to make in-laws with us. Your daughters you give to us, and our daughters you take for yourselves, and sit with us, for the land is before your face. Sit and trade in it, and be taken hold in it. Shechem said toward his father, her father, and toward her brothers, let me find favor in your eyes, and what you say toward me I will give. Cause it to be abundant on me exceedingly, purchase price and gift, and I will give as you say toward me, and give to me the young woman for a woman. So he's really bargaining. Just, I'll give you whatever it is. Just let me have her. I mean, verse 13, the sons of Jacob answered Shechem and Hamor his father with cunning. You know, you might, if you were underlining, you might underline key words that should scream at you with cunning. Let me tell you another word to say. They lied. I mean, you can excuse it, but with cunning, and they spoke that he defiled Dina, their sister, and they said toward them, we are not able to do this thing to give our sister to a man to whom is a foreskin, for it's a disgrace to us. Only in this will we be agreed to you, if you become as we, every male to you being trimmed back. It's literal for circumcised. And we will give our daughters to you, and your daughters take for yourselves, for ourselves, and we'll sit with you and become one people. And if you will not hearken toward us to be trimmed back, we will take our daughter and we will walk. And their spoken things were good in the eyes of Hamor and in the eyes of Shechem, the son of Hamor. And the lad did not delay to do the thing, for he had delight in the daughter of Jacob. And he was weighty from all the household of his father. And Hamor came and Shechem, his son, toward the gate of their city. And they spoke toward the men of their city, saying, these men, they are complete. They are whole with us. Let them sit in the land and trade in it. And the land, look, it's a width of two hands before their face. Their daughters let us take to ourselves for women and give our daughters to them. I'll explain some of this in a moment. Only in this will the men be agreed to sit with us, to become one people, that every man of us be trimmed back as they are trimmed back. Will not their acquired livestock, their acquisition, and their animals be to us? Only let it be agreed to them, and they will sit with us. And they hearkened toward Hamor and toward Shechem his son, and all the ones going out the gate of the city, every male was trimmed back, circumcised, and all the ones going out of the gate of his city. And it was on the third day, and they're being pained, when they're really hurting, right? They took two of the sons of Jacob, Simeon and Levi, brothers of Dinah, a man his sword, and they came upon the trusting city. I would underline that. And they killed every male. And Hamor and Shechem, his son, they slew with the mouth of the sword. And they took Dinah out of the house of Shechem, and they went out. And the sons of Jacob came upon those pierced, and they plundered the city. And they made unclean that had made unclean their sister, their flock, their herd, their donkeys, and that which was in the city and that which was in the field they took. And all their force and all their toddlers and their women they took captive and they plundered and all that was in the house. And Jacob said toward Simeon and Levi, you have stirred up me to cause me to stink with those sitters of the land among the Canaanites and among the Perizzites. I am men of account, and they will gather upon me and strike me, and I'll be destroyed, I and my house. And they said, as one fornicating, he makes our sister. I realize this is literal, so stick with me. Genesis 35:1. And Elohim said to Jacob, rise up, go toward Bethel, and sit there, and make there a slaughter place to the El who was seen toward you in the fleeing from the face of Esau, your brother. And Jacob said toward his household and to all who were with him, turn aside the Elohim of the foreigner that are in your midst. Sounds like he knows about something going on. And cleanse yourself and change your outer garments and let us arise and go up to Bethel, and I will make there a slaughter place to the El who answered me in the day of my distress and has been with me in the way that I have walked. And they gave toward Jacob all the Elohim of the foreigner that were in their hand and the rings that were in their ears, and Jacob hid them under the terebinth that was by Shechem. And as they pulled up stakes, the terror of Elohim was on all the cities that were around them, and they did not pursue the sons of Jacob. Almost finished. And Jacob came to Luz, that is, in the land of Canaan, that is Bethel, he and all the people who were with him. And he built there a slaughter place and called to the place El Bethel, because there the Elohim were revealed to him in his fleeing from the face of his brother. And Deborah, the one causing to suck of Rebekah, died. And she was buried below Bethel under the terebinth, and he called its name Alon Bakut. Now, I love literal. And I recognize as I read this that it's so literal, it feels choppy. Most translations don't want you to feel the feel of the original text. The reason I read it is because I want you to. I want certain things to strike you, and then I'll talk about them. I want to focus my comments towards religious people. You, me, us, even though a lot of people say, I don't like the term religious. I'm not religious. I have a relationship with God. You know, I've said that myself. But I want to talk to us collectively about the way we view Scripture and maybe make us think a little bit about some of these texts. Us. We make excuses for biblical characters. Or maybe we don't excuse it all the time, but we can read over something, and if it makes us go, ooh, we might say, oh, I can't think like that. That's the Bible. Give you a few examples. Noah gets drunk, passes out naked in his tent. And the story gets worse from there. That when we read that, we ought to go, oh my God. Now, here's what we do. We say, well, you know, back then they didn't know how powerful grape was. And, you know, it said he planted a vineyard and maybe he didn't get, you know, it got away from him. You know, you're sipping a little bit. Man, this is good, man. This is real good. Man, this is good. You know, I don't know. But, I mean, it got bad. So, but we excuse it. Now, here's what we know about Noah. Noah, it says, Noah, ish tzadik, tamim, bador tov. Noah was a righteous man in his generation. Now, we have to think about that. I mean, did he lose all his righteousness? Or can we talk about it? And we say, look, here is someone who was called righteous in his generation. Because through him, all the earth was saved. So I'm not taking his character, but I want you to understand that even the most righteous people make mistakes. And listen, get this, they do bad things. I mean, it's not, we don't have to make our biblical heroes perfect. We don't have to excuse their actions. If you came to me and said, can I get drunk and naked? Is that okay? I mean, it's in the Bible, a righteous man did it. I'm going to have to tell you no. I'm going to say I wouldn't advise it. I mean, I'm just telling you. Other people wouldn't say this stuff, probably. All right, Abraham. Abraham's the father of all the faithful. Surely Abraham didn't sin. And don't you say he did, Ross. Because that's sacred. When I said, I got more hate mail when I read Joshua 24 about how the children of Israel, it says basically that Abraham and they lived over across the river, and there they served other gods. And I said, look, I don't have this image in my mind of Abraham being a perfect monotheist who bashed his father's idols like some storybooks tell you, because I have a verse that says they were idolaters. And it makes the story better for me. He wasn't this holy guy with a halo on. He left idolatry and became a follower of the true God. But don't you talk about him. Let me tell you this. I don't, for what it's worth, I don't think I can agree with saying that your wife is your sister. It's just me. I mean, it's a lie. He said, this is my sister. Twice. Or sending a woman away, your wives, Genesis 25. If his women other than Sarah had children, it says he sent them both away. I mean, get it. I'm just saying we have to read these stories and be honest. Reuben went up on his father's bed. Not a good thing. One of the children of Israel. But we don't have to justify, and I don't think most people do, but you get my point. In other words, what I'm saying is these people were people. They lived, they breathed, they made mistakes. And the caution is when we read these stories of bad things, we don't have to say, but that's okay. Because here's what happens with religious nuts. They begin to say it's okay to do that because it's in Scripture. That's what's wrong with the world. I mean, really, it really is what's wrong with the world. Judah. Uh-oh. Don't talk about Judah. Judah, get this, goes with one of his buddies and sees a prostitute, by the way, gets her pregnant, right? Turns out it's his former daughter-in-law. This is not a pleasant story, but it's a story in the Bible. Now, here's what people do. They go through that real quick and they go, yeah, well, you know, back then it was, no. It's like people telling me, well, back then you couldn't eat certain foods because they couldn't get it hot enough. Fire's always been hot. Ever since fire was hot, right? So don't make excuses. Bad is bad. It's not relative. It doesn't really change with time. Rachel. Don't talk about Rachel. She had idols. She stole her dad's idols. So there's a couple of things going on there. Theft and idolatry. Bad enough to be an idolater, but you're going to steal somebody else's idols? Aaron. Uh-oh. Don't talk about Aaron. See, Aaron is the first high priest of Israel. Don't talk about Aaron. But Aaron, he makes, Moses is gone. He's been gone for a little while. He goes up to the mount. Moses is up there praying and fasting. And people are like, hey, where is Moses at? You seen Moses? We don't even know what happened to him. And they get together and they decide, I tell you what, y'all give me your earrings and jewelry and we're going to make an idol. Hey, that sounds like a good idea. And they do. And they all make this idol and Moses is coming back down and God tells him, look, wait, you got something waiting on you down there. Your people that you brought out. He doesn't even claim them anymore. And you read it. That's what it says. Your people that you brought. So he's going down. He gets down and he sees this frolicking in the camp. And guess what Aaron tells him? You ain't going to believe this, Moses. I know you're mad. I saw you just break the Ten Commandments that God gave you. But listen. Just between me and you, we threw into the fire the gold and out popped this calf. Swear to God. No, I'm not joking. That's what it says. Now, here's what happens. But see, we can't have the high priest commit a sin. So people start making stories. They make stories up. They lie to defend bad actions. And guess who does it? Religious teachers do this. Rabbis, sages, the brilliant minds of Torah. They make up stories. Let me tell you, it says in Deuteronomy chapter 9, verse 20, God was so mad at Aaron that he almost killed him. The only thing that kept God from striking Aaron down for this little deal was Moses interceding for him. Now, if you want to make excuses for Aaron and say that didn't happen, now listen to this. Let me tell you how bad the stories get. And I am through having a lot of patience with these stories. At first I was like, there's some cute stories. No, these are bad. Here's an example. You so want to take attention off of Aaron, because you can't have the high priest making an idol, that people say that it wasn't the children of Israel didn't do this. This is a story they tell. It was actually the mixed multitude. What the hell? What are you talking about? That, let me tell you who that says that is. Excuse me. I got excited. But here's the deal. They're saying that this people that did that wasn't Israelite. It was, they say that it was a mixed multitude just to... wasn't us. But that's a lie. Now, there was a mixed multitude with them. I'm not saying that they weren't part of this. I'm not saying that at all. It's the group. In fact, if I'm not mistaken, go check me. I mean, I read this a good bit. Seems like it says in the children of Israel, right?
The old one.
Yeah, that's right. Okay, there's a man after God's own heart. Look, I didn't set out to talk about this, but this has really been hitting me for the last few days. David is a man after God's own heart, the sweet psalmist of Israel. I love David. I sing the song, David Melech Yisrael. I mean, I love the stories of David. But David was on his roof one day. His soldiers were in battle. This is a warrior. But he had stayed back. And he sees a beautiful woman. Let me add something. A beautiful woman, not his, bathing on the roof of another home. He sends and brings her to his place, gets her pregnant. She belongs to another man. Well, you can't have that word get out on the street. So he calls the husband back from the battle lines, and he wants it to be a cover-up. He wants the husband to go sleep with his woman, so then, okay, she's pregnant. Well, yeah, she did. He did come back from the battle, but he doesn't go home. He sleeps out. You know, he's like, no, I'm not going to go. Hey, don't you want to go home? And I saw your wife earlier. No. He said, I can't do that. My brothers are out in the battle. I would never do that. He's probably wondering, what am I doing? Why am I here? You know the story. Ultimately, David, to cover up his crime, has his general, one of the leaders of his military, send Uriah to the front lines where he's killed. Now, guess who doesn't whitewash that story? The prophet. See, you have to call it like it is. When we see bad action, if we can't judge biblical text, how are we going to judge anything? If we can't look at a story and go, that's bad, that's good. If we can't do that, I mean, that's the simplest thing. And remember, making excuses for bad action is what causes religious nuts to blow people up. That's a problem in the world. The question is, do we seek to make the people in the Bible perfect? Do we make excuses for their behaviors? Does Israel slash Judah, collectively, separately, do they always behave properly? I mean, no. Let me help you. No. No, they don't. No, I mean, you can read, if you read, I'm going to say, if you read a paragraph in the prophets, pick one, you're going to find problems. Maybe a page. I don't think you can go very far. You can't go far without sin. And these are God's people. Listen, these are the people that are blessed and that should be, may not be correct, Grant, should be being blessings to other people. They should be blessing other people. And they're full of bad. The Bible doesn't excuse the actions of people like this. Rahab was a harlot, not an innkeeper. I know there are people who say, well, technically the word can... No. No. I'm sorry. I mean, I'm not saying that an innkeeper can't be a harlot. But don't try to make it sweet. Read it. The Bible is beautiful. Let me tell you, I can't tell you how many hours of my life I've invested in this book. I love the stories, but I'm honest with the stories. You don't need to tack on, and we call it embellishment. You know what embellish is? It's not really lying necessarily, but it's telling a story and you add some flair to it. I actually like to do that, but not when it comes to the Bible. I like the story to be the story because the writers do this for you. They tell you what it's supposed to tell you. But it's not as powerful. I think I feel like I'm getting us ready to read some really tough things. Because if I can get you today to start thinking, well, I'm not going to excuse that. So when you read it, it's got more force. Because if you read something, you go, oh, that's bad. But it's okay because you don't get the impact. And I think it's stunting our spiritual growth. I really do. I think that's where we're at. Here's the point, though. All these people that had problems and that did bad things, that God worked with and through them. And they're not perfect. You know why God worked with imperfect people? Get this. Because it's all he's got. Right? I mean, it really is. And if we think that it's otherwise, we're deceiving ourselves. So don't. And here's the other thing it does. When you read these stories, if you excuse her and you put people on a pedestal, a biblical character or a person in your own life, they're going to let you down. Can I be honest with you? They're going to let you down. I have enough self-critique. Like when I look at my own life and I go, oh, I probably need to work on this and this. I'm sure not going to make excuses for other people. It helps us, keeps us grounded, keeps us focused. God has always worked through imperfect people because it's all he has. But here's the other thing that I think about. Whenever someone, anyone, seeks to make a prophet, priest, Messiah, anybody, this one that never, ever, ever, ever had any problems or did, whenever that's going on, that ought to be a, whoa, wait a minute. Does that really make sense? So be careful with that. That's one of the main points. Most of the biblical, political and religious leaders, most, I hesitate to say all, but I'm close. Like, if here's most, here's all, I'm right here. Most of the biblical, religious, and political leaders of the Bible were bad. They were bad. I mean, if you think about it, they had flaws in their characters, and some of them were just downright evil. They had one thing in common. They were the people of Jehovah. One thing in common. They're called to be good and to be a blessing, to be blessed and to be a blessing. That's the thing they had in common. Now, whether they chose that or not, but see, the Bible's honest with whether they did or not. It's us who go in and try to make excuses and change the text or whatever. Now, one other thing while I'm kind of on a soapbox. There are people today, and you might know some of them. They might be on YouTube or iTunes or who knows. You might go to their synagogue or you might have seen them in a synagogue or you who knows. That say things like, I'm a descendant of David. I mean, that's pretty impressive. I mean, if you could claim descent from the king David, here's what it's supposed to do. If you tell me I'm a descendant of King David, I should go, what? Wow. That is so cool. You know what I do now? Because I've heard that. So was Achaz. You know who Achaz was? Yeah. So was Rehoboam. These are bad kings. So was Solomon. That doesn't mean, you don't impress, I'm not being ugly. I'm not mad. I'm actually, I feel good today. I just want you to get the point. So I'm being illustrative in my speech. Not like fired up at anybody in particular. I'm just saying. You being descended from David means less than a molehill to Jehovah. If your actions aren't in line with what he told David to do. This whole, I'm somebody because I'm somebody. No, you ain't. How about this? A descendant of Aaron. You ever heard anybody? A lot of teachers love this one. A lot of Bible teachers. Why? Because they think they get tithes then. But anyway. But what they'll do is they'll say, so-and-so, the right reverend or the right teacher, the so-and-so leader of the Hebrew roots movement of the whatever, seventh day, whatever, is a descendant of Aaron. Whoop-de-doo. I mean, really. So was Nadav and Abihu, and fire came out of the tabernacle and burnt them to a crisp. Descended from Aaron doesn't mean anything if your actions don't do what it is that they're supposed to do. Hophni and Pinchas, the sons of Eli, they were descendants. So what? It's not enough to have the right pedigree or the right names in your family tree. It really isn't. That does not put anybody in a place that makes them free of criticism. Biblical prophets don't, they're not scared. Remember when, like, Amos walks in and they tell him, don't come here with all that prophecy stuff. And he said, look here. I was just taking care of sycamore trees. I didn't ask for this job. What's he criticize? Let's look at Jeremiah. Jeremiah, this is Jehovah. Go stand in the gate of the temple and proclaim there this word. And Jeremiah would go, you got to be kidding me. Here we go again. I mean, Jeremiah will later say, I didn't have any friends. You can picture him like, because of you, I sat alone. He did. He said that. You call him the weeping prophet. He's as mad as he is crying. He says, I wish I could just go away and have a hotel in the wilderness for wayfaring men. Just get away from this people. But it was a fire shut up in his bones. You think he enjoyed being thrown in a dungeon for having a word that spoke against the religious establishment of his day? You know what the easiest thing to do right now on the internet is be that parrot, that wimpy teacher who says, well, this is what all the people say before me. This is what this means because this was in some commentary by so-and-so. That's easy. That's what's been going on for generations. Excusing bad behavior, making up stories that aren't biblical. What we need is a fresh dose of, no, I don't agree with that. I think it's called a spine. I really do. And I'm not a doctor. But I think it's somehow connected to a brain, isn't it? Somehow we ought to be able to stand up and think, you know, and make logical assessments and not excuse the behavior of teachers, ancient or modern or Doesn't mean don't be gracious and forgiving. That's not at all what I'm saying. Because as I pointed out, some of the greatest men and women in the Bible, some of the people that are called righteous, they make mistakes. They commit crimes. They do bad things. So we should be there for them. I'm not suggesting that. But don't excuse it, is what. Like Nathan. Nathan said, hey, I have a story for you. Here's the story. Certain man had a bunch of sheep. Another guy only had one sheep. And the guy with a lot of sheep saw the man with one sheep, and he liked the sheep that the one sheep guy had, and he took that sheep. What do you think about that? And David said, you ought to kill that guy. That's what you ought to do. Nathan said, well, interesting you should say that, because you're that guy. You're the one that stole the sheep. Did he defend David? No. There's a tendency for us to lift up. The Catholic Church does it with their priest. They really do. Like if a priest says something, And if the Pope says something, now here's why I started with I'm talking to our religious people. And because I got in trouble for this, for saying this before, so I'm not scared. Because it's true. People in our group look at people in that group and say, look at the way y'all do those priest, you give them all that special treatment. They have that cute little suit with the special tie, and you give them all the attention and kind of bow down to whatever they say. And now, in the Hebrew movement, in the Torah movement, is anybody treated kind of like that? Yeah. I mean, I've been to conferences before where they have special parking for the guy, whoever the guy is, whatever rabbi is. Like, don't let the old ladies park here, or old men, as the case may be, or someone who might have difficulty walking. We're going to put this place for our Come on, really? Now, all right. Jehovah demands more from his people than just the genetic makeup that he gave them to start. He gave them that. You can't get rid of that. You are what you are. What he's asking for is something that comes from each of us. Our dedication, our commitment, our holiness, our righteousness, our good behavior, our ability to stand up for what's right. That's what we bring to the table. You can't, you know, you heard a leopard can't change its spots. You really can't. I told somebody the other day, I don't know, you know, if I trace my lineage back, I might be a descendant of a Hittite or a Perizzite or a Girgashite. I don't know. But God's plan is open to all, if you have a heart right. Look at Isaiah 56. He says that from the nations, he's going to take that person who's not part of the people of Israel, and if they've grabbed hold of the covenant, and give them a place better than sons and daughters. Really? Well, that's something to think about. So what does that tell you? The important thing is grabbing hold of the covenant. He wants his people to grab hold of it, but he wants all people to grab, because ultimately it says that the knowledge of God will cover the earth as the waters cover the sea. The goal is that everybody gets into this. All right. Character flaws. Do we read anything in the story of Simeon and Levi that should make us give pause? They felt like, Simeon and Levi felt like they had to do what they did because, as it says in chapter 34, verse 31, They treated our sister like a prostitute. Now, by the way, I would encourage you to do a little bit of study on that. I don't have time to go into it today. The question, a lot of study Bibles will call this the rape of Dina. The rape of Dina. But if you look at the language, that can be challenged. Don't read too much into my comment. My point is, what does that title do? It automatically says, well, they deserved everything they got. Well, they got a lot. And then you have to ask yourself, what does the Torah say if, God forbid, rape does happen? Because there are debates. You know, a lot of scholars get into these questions and they say, you know, this is a rape culture and, you know, in the Bible and so forth and so on. Let me tell you something that I read in this story, whether it's rape or consensual or whatever. It doesn't matter because in the eyes of the biblical writer, you know what it says? This ought not be done. So that ought to tell you right there, it's not condoned, whatever happened. But it's the reaction to it that I wanted to focus on for just a minute. Because we sometimes have a tendency to say they deserved everything they got. So they lied to the men of Shechem in verse 13. They didn't come in the heat of the moment and say, we heard what you did to our sister and beat him up. I mean, I could almost see that, you know, if Levi and Simeon said, did you hear that? Dad, we're going to go take care of this boy in town and beat him to a pulp. I mean, I'm not condoning violence. I'm just saying. I can understand if that's what the story said. That's not what happens. They go and they say, hey, how's it going? You know Levi? Yeah, I'm Simeon. Yeah, how's it going? Good to be here in your neighborhood. Here's the deal. We heard y'all want to take our women and we want to give you ours and, you know, and that whole deal. But in order to do that, you see, we have this special rule and, you know, kind of uncomfortable to talk about, but you have to be circumcised. And so if you do this, if everybody in your town does this, we'll be happy to, you know, okay, thanks, see you later. We'll come back in a few days. And they do come back in a few days. Now, the men of the town get together. Now, this is what's bizarre. They get together and they have a talk and they say, hey, you know, they said if we do this, you don't think somebody in there would have said, nah, I'm going to stick with a local girl or something. But they all say, hey, sounds good. Let's do it. We're all going to do it. And it says they all do it. 3 days in when they're sore, here comes Simeon and Levi, sword in hand. Now remember, it's in the heat of the moment thing, because a lot of people like to excuse them that way. Well, if they did that to my sister, I'd do it. Oh, they've already been there, lied to them, been gone 3 days, and now they're coming back. And they left their sister with him, by the way, all this time. Oh, we don't want to... Yeah, I never thought about that. So 3 days later, sister's still there. God knows what's happening. And they come with swords. Says they slew who? Every male. How to teach them. They won't do that again because there's no men left. But they didn't stop there. They stole the sheep and the oxen and the donkeys. But that didn't stop there. They captured and despoiled all their wealth, all their infants, and their women and everything. This is one of those stories that ought to make your stomach churn. It's that bad, in my opinion. You know who else felt that way about it? Jacob. See, meanwhile, while people are excusing their actions, Jacob didn't. Jacob says in verse 30, Genesis 34:30, look at this with me. Jacob said, Genesis 34:30, and Jacob said to Shimon and Levi, "You have brought trouble on me to make me odious, like you make me stink among the inhabitants of the land, among the Canaanites and the Perizzites. And I, being few in number, they'll gather themselves together against me and slay me, and I shall be destroyed, I and my house." And look what they, and then here's their response, verse 31. They said, "Should he deal with our sister as with a harlot?" Like this. "What do you think, Dad? You think we should just let it go?" You almost want to read the next verse and say, "No, but I don't think you should have done this. My God, man, look at what you've done. You destroyed an entire city." Later, we'll look at this too. It's like they hamstrung the animals. Just cruel. Anyway. Look at Genesis 49. In Genesis 49, wow, I've gone long today. Genesis 49, verse 5. Look at verse 5. Shimon and Levi are brothers. By the way, just to give you the setting, this is Jacob on his dying, on his deathbed. It says he tells his sons, "Gather yourselves together and I'll tell you what will befall you in the latter days." So this is like prophetic. Listen to what he says. "Shimon and Levi are brothers, instruments of cruelty are their swords. Let my soul not come into their council, to their assembly. Let my honor not be united. For in their anger they slew a man, and in their self-will they lamed an ox. I will divide them in Yaakov and scatter them in Israel." You know what happened to Simeon and Levi? They were scattered. Who's the one who uses the knife all the time? Let me think about this. You think about that. Should we make excuses for bad behavior or seek to modify our behavior based on the stories that we read? In other words, don't make excuses. When you read bad, you call it bad, and you say, "We can't do that." There's a Talmudic saying that I like. I really like this one. And it says, God is exacting to a hair's breadth with those closest around him. In other words, if you claim to be of God or for God, you better behave accordingly, because otherwise you're going to get direct retribution. I mean, think Hophni and Pinchas. Nadav and Avihu. It's not like we're seeing people get struck down, you know, in that sense. Maybe that literally. But I would be very careful because of that idea. I'll close with this. Our reading today begins and ends at an altar. And a place, I would say, where communion with God is known to have taken place. I would encourage us today, as we think about these things, to find a place where we can, too, draw near to God and perhaps commune with Him. Because I think that's what we need to do. We need to examine ourselves. We need to not make excuses for our own behaviors. And in a way, look for ways to bless those around us. It doesn't mean that we should excuse the actions of the character who took Dina either. I'm not suggesting that at all. I'm not suggesting turn the other cheek. I'm not good at that myself. But I am saying we should look very, very hard at the way that we respond in situations and make sure that we're representing the one that we claim to represent. Shabbat Shalom.